This is writer and game designer Robin D. Laws.
And this is game designer and writer Kenneth Height.
And this is our podcast, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff.
Bandwidth brought to you by Pelgrane Press.
Stuff we're here to talk about in this episode include...
Story beats in your game.
Unauthorized biolabs.
Building a horror mythos.
And mail order occultist Sydney Flower.
Big news from Mission Control. If you missed out the first time, don't panic. The wait is over. The Catstronauts board game is finally back in stock at Atlas Games.
That's right. Catstronauts sold out almost immediately on release, but the reprint has officially landed. Now you can finally bring the kitty crew home to your tabletop.
And just in time, too, because things are getting interesting on the International Space Station.
Giant laser pointers in space and a live stream of nose boops? What's not to like? Let's check out how the Catstronauts are doing up there.
Oh man, there goes Waffles the pilot. He's off to see how many kibble bits can achieve orbit around his belly. A pioneer in snackodynamics, that cat.
Careful, Waffles. If the other Catstronauts catch you clogging the air filters with crumbs again, it's back to litter box duty for you.
Look at them working together. Waffles is keeping the station steady, Pom Pom is swatting at fasteners like feather toys, and Major Meowser is... napping on the instructions.
Teamwork at its finest. You can lead this kitty crew yourself in the official Catstronauts board game.
It's a cooperative challenge featuring pawsome art by the comics creator Drew Brockington, and it's perfect for gamers of all ages.
But remember, the first printing disappeared at light speed. Don't let this reprint of Catstronauts slip through your claws.
Secure your copy today at atlas-games.com/catstronauts. That's atlas-games.com/catstronauts.
Rattle of dice, the thump of miniatures, the crunch of Doritos, and the benevolent gaze of Peter Frampton coming alive once more welcome us into the gaming hut. And once more in the gaming hut, it's not so much that something is rotten as we have a new way to track how rotten something is. The GM, as always, has his princely crown and his demeanor of philosophic melancholy because we're once more behind Hamlet's GM screen, Robin's sequel to Hamlet's hit points in which he applies the beat mapping mechanics, not just to beloved films and all story, but to your table specifically. You, that's right, you listening right now. And how can we apply them to my table? You don't even know. I hear all of your objections. We're going to go through it. And to begin with, we're going to go through the beat types as previously noted. Right, Robin?
Right. So we talked about the beat analysis system a lot on this podcast, but we're going to talk about it now as a refresher because we're going to mine this upcoming or available in the Pelgrane store in July book for a number of topics in a little series we're going to do. So let's start with the basics, the basic building blocks of narrative. Usually I've talked about these by referring to examples in film and novels and television, what have you. Well, this time around, in keeping with the whole point of Hamlet's GM screen, which is to directly apply beat analysis to classic moments at the gaming table, I will use gaming examples as I discuss all of these. So I'm going to start with the first of these beat types, which is the procedural. This is the most important beat type in any sort of adventure-oriented or problem-solving role-playing game, which is to say the vast number of games that are going to be played at any table this week will mostly use the procedural beat, and that is one in which a character is trying to overcome an external obstacle of some kind, possibly literally physical obstacle, but definitely external to them. And so examples of this at the gaming table are hitting an opponent, climbing a wall, fixing a malfunctioning plane. So pretty well any roll you make against a skill is probably, although not necessarily always, a procedural beat.
Right. And as with the classic dyad of your story types, where there is procedural, there must be drama. So the next beat is the dramatic beat.
Right. So this is the inverse of the procedural beat, where the procedural beat is an external situation. The dramatic is internal, is emotional, is one character seeking something from another that will change their emotional state. There are exceptions to this. So, for example, in a monologue, you can be seeking something emotionally from yourself, which is sounds weird, except it's something we do constantly, is try to change our own moods. So examples of that at the role-playing table is you've come back from your mission and you go to your mentor or the person who assigned you the mission and you're seeking approval from them. And that's a dramatic beat. Or also the thing about beats in a gaming situation is that they are not the product of a single author the way they are when there's a dramatist or a screenwriter or a novelist. But these beats can be introduced by anybody at the table. So, for example, when the player characters are debating the moral implications of a proposed action, you are not necessarily introducing that as GM, although you've probably introduced the situation that causes it. But you can have a dramatic beat when one player character seeks something emotionally from the other. There's an external aspect to it in that case because you're debating what to do, but the characters are interacting emotionally. So that's a dramatic beat. Or when you rescue the friend who's the object of the whole mission to get them out of the terrible situation at the dark house, the beat where the player character interacts with the game master character is a dramatic beat.
So what about games that have emotional combat or emotional hit location type mechanics? And this could be anything from roll persuade against the guard to let you through to a debate against another vampire and you're trying to lower their willpower by making a series of ugly points about their ancestry. That's sort of a using procedural mechanics, but to derive a dramatic beat, how would you signpost that? Or would it be a depends on what the play mood is at the table?
It can depend, but I do have a dividing line that I use to distinguish these two things when that matters, which is that if you care about the person that you're using an interpersonal ability on or the social combat system, if you want something internal, an emotional change in state from them, that's a dramatic beat. If you don't care about them, if they are just a means to an end, like the recalcitrant witness who you will talk to for one scene and never meet again, or, you know, the king who you don't really like or care about, but you want him to decide something in your favor. So if you don't care about them, if you just want something external that you're getting through a conversation, I would normally count that as a procedural beat.
All right, leaving that dichotomy behind, no doubt to be teased out further in another episode, let's talk about the commentary beat, ironically, since that's what we just did.
Right. So the commentary beats happen at the gaming table a lot more often than they do in fiction. In a movie, it's especially jarring when the character turns to the camera and editorializes, or sometimes it is a fun part of the gag. But at the gaming table, it's quite often the case that you or other players will introduce a beat that is just commenting on the action without actually furthering it and is to some degree outside of the action. So, for example, if you are playing a GMC in a 1930s game and he starts to discourse on a storm cloud gathering over Europe and the threat posed by Hitler, if that doesn't go anywhere in particular except to exist for its own sake, to set the stage, you know, remind the players that, hey, it's World War II's coming, that's a commentary beat. And just as often, a player character may introduce a level of commentary. There's a ton of riffing at the gaming table, some of it comical, some of it serious. So, for example, if a player starts to sort of go down the rabbit hole of what are the ethics prevailing here at this weird space station, and they're not trying to get anything out of saying that, it's a statement made for its own sake, that is also a commentary beat. And also very, very commonly in role-playing and not in other passive media, people will break character to comment not only on the action, but about something completely different. So if one person does something that reminds them of the new Star Wars movie and someone decides to, you know, tangent in and start complaining about Grogu, that's a commentary beat. And of course, that implies that some commentary beats are more germane than others, especially the ones that don't have any particular emotional relevance to what's happening. You as GM will want to step in And, okay, let's talk about Grogu afterwards. Let's get back to the space station.
Everyone has clearly been waiting with bated breath for the next beat, which is the anticipation beat.
Right. So this is a beat where you pre-enjoy something because we know that something great is going to happen. And we have a little extra moment before it happens when we enjoy how great that moment is. So, for example, the moment when you're going to be a badass, when you pull the dark sword from its scabbard and, whenever you pull that sword, you get to use it once per session and you do 48 damage and you never miss. Well, saying, I pull my mighty sword. Everybody, all the other players can enjoy it. You can enjoy it. The GM can enjoy it. That's an anticipation beat. Or also an anticipation beat can be created by a number of failures, right? If it's been really hard to open the door and then suddenly you finally open the door, everybody gets very excited and starts thinking about what's on the other side of the door. Or also sort of in a way that kind of bridges mechanics and playing in character. Mechanically, someone has just scored a critical hit, and it's one of those systems where the player gets to define something about the action or the world because of great role. And the moment between the role and the description is an anticipation beat.
And following on to anticipation, of course, we get gratification.
Right. So a gratification beat is one where something happens that is not part of the direct flow of the narrative, but that the author, or in this case, the GM, or sometimes a player, but in this case, mostly the GM, introduces in order to lighten or brighten the mood. So, for example, if you've described the characters trudging through a horrific torrential rain and they're starting to get a little too bummed about your realistic descriptions of how horrible it is to move through the Amazon in the 18th century, then you say, well, the clouds of doom, they part. And now the beautiful parrots are flying past and there's a smell of jasmine in the air. That is you using narrative description to lighten the mood. Or a classic thing that only occurs at the gaming table, really, or perhaps in a video game, is you get to go to town and spend all of your loot. Now, that may start to get boring after a little while, but the initial loot buying, very exciting, very exciting. Or, to go to another mechanical example, is you've just all gotten the experience points needed to level up. Everybody, you're leveling up. So that's a gratification that's very specific to our form.
And where there's gratification in this Vale of Tears, there must necessarily also be the bring down beat, which is kind of the opposite, I'm assuming, right?
Yes, absolutely the opposite. And you probably need to go out of your way to bum the players out less often than you need to go out of your way to cheer them up. But in horror, your whole point, they're at the table to be brought down, to be horrified, to be scared. And so, for example, they can be hanging out in the haunted house and they've been talking for a little while and gotten a little too mellow. And maybe there's even some comic riffing going on. And so then you say, and then you hear a horrible skittering noise reverberating through the entire house. You're not sure where it's coming from. Maybe it's coming from everywhere. And all of a sudden, you've got everybody scared again, and the mood has gone down from lax to scary.
Now, is there an overlap between, I guess, gratification and bring down and dramatic beats in which the GMC is trying to create a feeling in the player characters and perhaps even through the players? Because you mentioned, something, scary happens to scare you. What if it's a vampire and he shows up and he says, bow down and worship me, or flee this place, or something? He is maybe also trying to get an action out of them, but he's mostly trying to get, emotion of awe or fear. And then simultaneously, or rather conversely, you could have, in a high F20 game, you could have a Lamashtu or an angel show up and do the opposite. Or in a more conventional game, oh, the medic is coming over the hill and he says, okay, everybody, calm down, I'm here. Or the friendly GMC priest shows up and says, let's all take a moment and pray for our deliverance. And that is meant to create an emotional state as well. Are those more overlappy?
With the possible exception of the last one, those all sound like things that are intrinsic to the storyline that are achieved with procedural and dramatic beats, because if both of those move the emotional arrow up and down. Mm-hmm. That procedural beat moves it up when you succeed, moves it down when you fail. A dramatic beat moves the line up when the character gets what they want, moves the line down when a character loses their emotional footing. And so gratifications and bring downs are sort of a more obvious authorial intervention in order to change the mood when you don't have the procedural and dramatic beats in the main storyline to do that for you. So the opposite of the torrential rain parting is the torrential rain starting, right? That is not as, that's a background detail that paints something in the mood. If the torrential rain is, well, I've got, you know, six flooding related hazard roles for you to undertake, that's probably more of a procedural. But if it's just the fact that it's raining that you introduce, that's more of a bring down.
Right.
So essentially gratification and bring down are the seasoning that you throw in when you don't have a main beat to possibly create the up or down movement that you're looking for.
Okay. In the background, the GM is busily laying down pipe. And so we have the pipe beat.
Right. So the pipe is one of the rarest of the beats here, but it's useful particularly in mysteries, and it's related to sort of the triad of informational beats. And a pipe beat is simply one where you introduce information that will matter later. And ideally, you do that in a less than obvious manner so that when you do bring it back, they go, oh, that's what the rat with the little fez was all about. It was indicating that he's a member of the secret society or what have you. So any little, you know, you describe the vacation resort that the characters go to, and you make sure you describe the secret passageway that they'll need to escape into later in a way that doesn't give away that that's what that is. Or you're describing the stylized archway in a dungeon, and it turns out that, guess what, that's a portrait of the wizard that you'll be meeting later in the dungeon. So those sort of things that you're setting something up without obviously doing so, so that later the characters can go, oh. But the main pair of informational beats starts with the question beat. And this is the one in which, as the term goes, you introduce a question that the players are going to want to have answered. And questions almost always point the arrow down because they create suspense. Because suspense, as well as failure, creates tension, creates something that needs to be dispersed later. And so, you know, the player goes, who owns this mysterious logging camp? Or why is the artificial gravity on the space station wrong? Or the butler has been murdered. All of those things pose questions, and they all point the arrow down.
Yeah, and I guess if they didn't know the butler, it's not even a dramatic beat. It's just a question beat. And so for the question, then you have the answer or the reveal beat, right?
Right. So the reveal usually creates a paired emotional effect where the question points the arrow down and the answer points the arrow up, because you were feeling edgy because there's something you didn't know, and now you know, so it's everything's better. So you find out who owns the logging camp, or you discover, oh, there's a phase parasite that's causing the gravitational anomaly, or, oh, look, there's the bloody knife that was used to stab the butler, because sometimes the reveal is not a full answer to the question, but at least is a step toward answering the question. The one thing, though, is that sometimes a reveal is a crossed beat. It's both up and down, because on one level, you are happy to have gotten a piece of information and be moving toward the answer. But sometimes the answer itself is also alarming. So if you discover that, oh, the butler has been killed by a mysterious wasting disease, that, oh no, is this related to our previous expedition to Egypt? Then you can have sort of an ambiguous mixed beat arising from that. So those are all of the narrative beats, the basic building blocks of story. Why do we care about this? Well, in addition to just paying attention to whether things are going up and down, and many of these beats can tell us whether things have gone up or down. The bring down obviously is a downbeat. The question is a downbeat. The reveal is an upbeat. In other narratives, we don't necessarily care so much about achieving a balance of all of these. There are tons of stories in particular that are just drama beats. There's no external action. There's no suspense. Other stories are just pure procedurals. But at the traditional gaming table in particular, we want to make sure that there's a variety of these different beats occurring in order to satisfy the different players and their different interests at the table. There's someone who loves interaction and loves playing their character. So if you make sure there's some dramatic beats in there, or you give them an opportunity to throw in their own dramatic beats proactively, that's even better. If you've got a problem solver, you want to make sure there's lots of problem solving to happen. And if there's someone who enjoys mysteries, you want to have lots of questions introduced. If you're just all there to kick a bunch of monsters hiding behind doors, you want to make sure there are less of those or less time is spent on them. So making sure that your story has the opportunity to have all of these beats in it makes it appealing to the broadest range of player tastes.
Well, now that we've laid out our arsenal of beats and begun to stick them to the wall, going up and down, figuring out why we're doing it, I think that we have set the scene for future explorations here in the fictive kingdom of Denmarkistan, and we may move into the anticipation beat that is a wonderful ad. In a hole in the ground, they found a body.
I know! Here we are in Maryshire, right in the middle of the beautiful bucolic riding.
So bucolic.
With its neat hedgerows, and picturesque taverns, and delightful crumpet shops, and quaint little village greens.
Yeah, can we go back to the crumpets?
Yes, what did you want to know about them?
I wanted to have some crumpets and shut off the recording.
Okay, let's do that.
Okay, we're back. What were we saying?
Murder!
Murder?
Yes, we've got murder to solve.
In the bucolic riding? Where all the halflings live?
Yes, the halflings. Plus also some boggarts, pukas, and dwarves. But weren't we concerned about something?
Murder?
Yes, murder! Another case in need of sleuthing by a team of amateur detectives.
It would be unthinkable if this wasn't the third murder this week.
Maryshire Detective Club is a fantasy mystery-solving RPG.
By the master of fantasy and mystery.
And fantasy mystery.
Gareth Ryder Hanrahan.
Investigate crimes, question and eccentric neighbors, stop for tea and cakes, unravel puzzles, and get involved in pedantic arguments about jam.
Wait, what kind of jam?
In the most adorable,
but still murdery,
gumshoe game yet, you gather clues, uncover motives, follow gossip, question suspicious neighbors, stop for lunch, get sidetracked, remember you're supposed to be solving a case, gather some more clues, question more eccentric locals,
possibly chase a swan or something,
and slowly piece together the truth.
Coming soon to Backer Kit from Pelgrane Press.
Type Backer Kit and Maryshire into your favorite search engine to find the launch page. The crinkle of the newsprint. The ink getting all over our hands. The cries of the news urchins advertising the newest edition tell us that we're once more looking at a story that is absolutely contemporary, that is ripped from the headlines. And this time around, we're going to look at unauthorized biolabs, which means that we could also have called this the William Gibson Hut, because this is one of the most cyberpunk stories that we've covered in a while. It's also a little bit sciency. It's also a lot crime blottery. It could go in a lot of different huts. So Ken, was the unauthorized biolab story on your radar before I dropped this into the script? Because this happened a while ago, but it's sort of really only started making the rounds to my notice very recently.
Yeah, it was on my radar when it happened, not to spoiler, but the first time it happened, yes. And then it happened again. And that definitely sort of got my attention. And again, no spoilers, but anyway, the story begins in December 2022 with a building in Reedley, California, that was owned by a company that, among other things, is called Prestige Biotech. And because corporate shells are kind of part of the story, but they're also not relevant, I'm just going to call it Prestige, even though it was also UMI and a bunch of other things. But a building code officer, of all things, is looking at the building and they see a green hose coming out the side. And they say, that's weird. This building isn't cleared to have a green hose. I wonder what's going on in it. And she opens the door and shows her ID and discovers the building is full of Chinese nationals in gas masks. Some of them are in, you know, weak hazmat suits, vast racks of vials in various shelves and containers. And she discovers over 1,000 badly neglected mice, which later turned out to be transgenic mice.
Right. And I just want to stop and note the irony here, with a little bit of foreshadowing, which is that we're entering a story that is full of government regulatory neglect, that enforcement time and time again seems to have gone completely out the window. But apparently the one thing that's still working is local building code inspection. And some one person was on the ball, found a hose that wasn't supposed to be there, and ripped the lid off of this rip from the headline story. So she goes and says, hey, there's all these guys in hazmat suits and transgenic mice and weird vials. Everyone else in the government structure is as on the ball as I am. So she goes to the cops, and Ken, what happens?
Well, she goes to her superiors and they say, we should check this out. And she reports it to the CDC, because when you find a whole bio lab that no one knew about, maybe it's the CDC's business. And the CDC completely refuses to investigate or to test any samples. And they hang up on the local law enforcement over and over again. They call the FBI.
And this is before the gutting of the CDC and other federal agencies.
Yes. Yes. That's back when the CDC was working off its glorious reputation during the last pandemic. So yeah. Why do people suspect public health is bad in this country? Who can say? Anyway, the FBI opened an investigation when they were called and then announced that they closed it again within 2 months and did nothing. And so this is in February of 2023. So the Reedley cops at some point do return. They find only two of the Chinese nationals on site. They both run away when questioned. And most of the building is now padlocked. So we're at a brief, you know, impasse, waiting for the CDC to get back to you. That gets nothing done. In March of 2023, the Reedley cops get an entry and inspection warrant, break off the locks, go in and find lots and lots of tissue and blood samples, plus thousands of vials of unknown pathogens, some of them labeled in English, some of them labeled in Chinese, some of them labeled in code. They find a lot of flammable and poisonous chemicals, so it's already an environmental violation on the site, plus two ultra-low temperature freezers and 29 other freezer-fridge combos to store the various samples. At this point, a rep from the company says, hey, can we get the mice back? They're very expensive transgenic mice, and therefore giving people COVID. So could we have those back? And the cops say, no, you can't have those back. And they say, well, how about our samples? Can we have those back? We'll send a truck. And they say, what company is the truck from? And they say, Prestige Truck Company.
Yeah, it's Junk R Us.
And they say, you don't have a license to haul away bio samples. No, you can't do it. So now it's escalated to the county. Fresno County investigates in April, confirm all the findings of the Reedley cops. California State Department of Public Health is finally involved in May. And among their findings, and this is a quote from the Congressional Subcommittee report, many of the indecipherable containers appeared to contain blood or a blood product, such as serum or other bodily fluids. So there's your Knight's Black Agents hook right there. Eventually, someone has called their congressman, a guy named Jim Costa, a Democrat representing Reedley, and he gets involved. And lo and behold, here comes the CDC. And they show up and they say, don't worry, we've got it. No, they don't. They spend 2 days on site. They test no samples, even the ones labeled COVID-19. They assess the vials based on a few English language labels. Don't attempt to translate the Chinese or break the code on the coded ones. And they say, you should send a stern letter to Prestige and tell them that they're in violation. Well, glad we've solved your problem. That's the CDC for you. Peace out.
Yes. Are unauthorized biolabs really unauthorized when no one is enforcing anything?
Right. That is the question. And so this basically leaves the matter in the hands of the local cops. Them and Fresno have both offered to pay to ship the samples safely to somewhere where they can be tested. CDC says, stop calling us. We've shown up. We sent a letter. What more can we do? We're the Center for Disease Letter Sending, not the Center for Disease Control. So they begin abating the site. This is in July of 2023, and they find a freezer labeled Ebola that somehow was missed by the CDC in its inventory. When the congressional subcommittee asked, the CDC said, well, we didn't see any freezer like that. And the congressional subcommittee said, yes, that's literally what we're investigating.
Yeah, a freezer labeled Ebola is of no interest to the CDC. Who do you think we are?
Right. So the congressional investigation, as I've mentioned, begins September of 2023. This is by the Select Subcommittee on Competition with the Chinese Communist Party. And once the Congress is investigating, now the FBI suddenly does its job. And so in October of 2023, along with the FDA, they arrest the director of the biolab, a Chinese national named Zhu Jiabai, and they charge him with medical device fraud also because he was selling fake COVID tests as a side gig. And Zhu Jiabai, once you turn over that rock, turns out to be a Chinese Communist Party member. He chaired a number of Chinese military-owned or directed firms in the early 2000s. He was extensively involved in the Chinese cattle industry. He basically owned a controlling interest in it. And he was illegally in the country under a fake name since 2015. He was wanted in Canada because he came over the Canadian border. And while in Vancouver, he'd set up another bunch of shell companies to steal cattle-related intellectual property, you know, genetic material, stuff like that. And also,
and it sounds alarming when you say cattle-related IP, but the vast majority of that was like drum and bass records made by cows. So only part of that was important IP.
Right. And also, he'd been running various medical frauds in Canada, so he'd racked up like a $300 million operation there.
Well, I'm glad we were paying attention. Yeah.
Well, he skipped out and headed to America under a fake name. So apparently, Ali Oxenfree. He'd previously set up a biolab in Fresno, but he had to flee it to Redley after a fire and a threatened eviction, which apparently did not have anyone say, maybe follow this guy around. And he'd received $1.3 million in mysterious payments from Chinese banks, which, again, raises more questions than it answers. The Select Committee Chair John Molinar, Republican of Iowa, says, Americans learning about this biolab will ask an entirely reasonable question. How many other clandestine laboratories exist in the United States? What I find the most disturbing is not necessarily that we do not know the answer to this question. It is that no one does. And to John Molinar, I would say, I'll bet the Chinese Communist Party does.
Assuming they're the only ones setting right. up unauthorized
yes, this is true.
Biolabs.
Pakistan has illicit biolabs in other countries in their region, so who can say? But fortunately, at least Zhu's reign of bioterror has been ended by quick FBI action, and by quick, I mean 10 months. But of course it's not. In February of 2026, after reports by cleaners of mysterious illnesses and of horrid smells by the neighbors, cops enter a house in Las Vegas, very near Nellis Air Force Base, to find another biolab. Fridges, vials, big jars of bad chemicals, lab equipment in the garage, etc. The FBI says the samples are too degraded to test properly, but they do at least give it the old college try and send some of them to Fort Detrick for the Army to test. No one is embarrassing anyone by involving the CDC at this stage.
Right. And so both of these labs, one of the illegal activities going on there is the repackaging of fake Chinese manufactured COVID tests, as you mentioned already, but also pregnancy tests and urine tests. So they're taking these counterfeit things and then putting them in new packaging so that they appear to be authentic and US made. And so the question of why does he have Ebola? What's going on there? So if you're hoping for not an unalarming, but a less alarming answer to why he has Ebola and all of these serums and quantities of blood, is that it could possibly have been that he was trying to expand in from his counterfeit testing service into legit tests. Because it turns out that if you have a legit looking website and a corporate filing, if you can show them your LLC papers, I guess, online, anybody in America, so listen up, American listeners, can order a pathogen of their own from an accredited supplier. The standards for who they ship Ebola to or any of these other pathogens, close to non-existent. So you just have to claim that you're making a test kit. So, well, yeah, we're in the Ebola testing business. Here's your Ebola. Here you go. So was he trying to do that? Was it bioterror? Hard to say. But if you're looking for one, there is a Still disturbing, but less disturbing answer.
But we're not done with our cycle of government competence yet. So the FBI arrests the property manager at this Vegas site, a guy named Ori Solomon, and he says he knows nothing about it. He just keeps the place up, and it's like, really? The property is owned by Jews LLC and purchased in 2022, maybe as a backup, maybe as part two of the plan, who can say? And Zhu had contacted the manager over 400 times in January alone from federal custody. So everyone doing a great job. Pat everyone on the back. This system is working perfectly. Surely there are only two biolabs, Robin, and they've both been stopped by alert local officials. The end. Nothing to worry about.
Right.
Not like we have any sort of broad pandemic vulnerability in this country, whatever.
And this was the super sloppy biolabs that were emitting smells and had hoses running out of them and that were, you know, obviously, you know, even by the standard of an unauthorized biolab, not well run and got caught.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess there's no way, we don't have to worry that there's other more efficiently run ones with better OPSEC that are not getting caught.
But the whoever the Ministry of State Security A-team is running the good biolab somewhere in New Jersey. We don't have to worry about that at all.
Right. So the horror role-playing applications are obvious. You've already mentioned this could be a blood experimentation lab that is either part of a conspiramid or some sort of Hinky Van Helsing is running in order to create, you know, blood that explodes when vampires drink it. And it could either be owned by vampires or of interest by vampires.
Or he's trying to create a version of these pathogens that will infect vampires if they drink the blood with it.
Yeah. And you could even credibly move this from the regulatory Wild West of America to Europe, where Night's Black Agents usually happens. There's a whole bunch of places in and around Europe where similarly lax or corrupt practices could happen to allow such a lab. In a modern Cthulhu game, of course, you know, essentially they're working on essential salts or Yogg-Sothoth immunization juice. They could be producing, you know, Herbert West chemicals that are used for reanimation. And in the esoterists, of course, this could be someone trying to science their way into breaking the membrane. And perhaps the unauthorized biolab, because it is so terrifying, because there's an Ebola fridge, could be a fake in order to just get in the news and alarm people and create a sense of danger and horror, which themselves the Outer Dark entities feed on.
Right. And then some infectious Outer Dark horror gets in through the concern about it. And in that way, the CDC, I guess, by not caring at all, is fighting the good fight against esoterror. So
they're part of the Ordo. That's their indifference right. Veil out is what they call it over mm-hmm. there.
The veil out of not veiling out, very Zen.
Well, we definitely make sure that just like the Ordo, every case has a firm conclusion, and we firmly concluded this segment. But I bet we're going to open up another one on the other side of this commercial.
Play The King in Yellow has haunted imaginations like a dirge since its first appearance in 1895.
But among the fortune tellers of Europe, the play was not the fearful beginning of something new, but the culmination of something older, The King in Yellow Tarot.
Daniel Harms and John Scott Tynes, famous clairvoyants, divined the form's importance of this Carcosan deck.
Painter Kurt Komoda, in a fevered fugue of inspiration, reproduced designs thought long lost.
Spread the cards.
Let the King in Yellow tell your fate.
There is no other who could.
After all, you have seen the yellow sign.
The King in Yellow Tarot is a complete deck of 78 cards in full color.
Sturdy cards with a soothing, silky finish.
Inspired by the works of Robert W. Chambers.
An accompanying 28-page guide explores the history of the deck and recommends, hesitantly, its technique.
A complete PDF of cards and guide comes with your order.
Add to cart at shop.arcdream.com.
That's your reality-shattered cart at shop.arcdream.com. Keep this podcast authorized, by which we mean extant, by joining beloved Patreon backers
Mo Lane,
Monster Talk,
Svebor Mijic,
Christian Grunseth,
and Andrea Coletta.
The clanking of chains, the spooky sounds from the basement, and the dark shadows in the corners welcome us, or do they, into the horror hut, where beloved Patreon backer Christian Grunseth asks, I am planning to make a horror mythos from scratch, loosely based on British 70s horror like the Stone Tapes. Do you have any tips or pointers of what you need in a good horror mythos and what pitfalls to avoid when crafting one? Robin, what are the sort of ne plus ultras of our horror mythoses?
As we often do, and as if there's a ghost in front of us, I will take a step back to ask the question, what is the point of this horror mythos? Why are you introducing, presumably, you know, a level of lore that continues over a series of scenarios? What effect are you trying to have? Because, of course, the most popular horror mythoses, Lovecraft's and also something like the X-Files, to name an example that went a little sideways, accreted them over time. They didn't sit down, create a series Bible for cosmic horror or for UFOs, but just added more stuff in order to create the idea that there's a connected universe. So one answer is you don't need to worry about it. Just create what you need as you go along. But I think a lot of people now today sort of expect a coherent operating system behind the horrors. And especially if it's an investigative game, a good thing to have is sort of a unitary supernatural theory that explains why everything is happening. So Knights Black Agents, it's vampires, Yellow King, it's Carcosa. And in your case, it is some sort of combination of folk horror meets science. And so part of having a mythos is to have thematic unity to it. So I would say start out by establishing what is my theme? What are my motifs? What are the images associated with that? And also, what is the thing that this horror mythos is saying? So this Stone Tape is sort of indicating that in good old horror fashion, that the hubris of scientific inquiry will always be punished with information and terror. And that's a perfectly sound mission statement for the horrors in your world. And then when you're asking yourself, do I want this new element in here? The answer is, does it relate to that through line?
The other great horror mythoses do come with a series Bible. It's the Bible. So you have the horror mythos of The Conjuring, in which we have a recognizably Christian universe mythos onto which you sort of layer the specific entities that are the big bads, your Annabelle, the evil nun, etc. And those are part of the backstory. And so, you know, when they made the nun, they didn't think, well, this will be the mean ghost that will scare everybody forever. They said, oh, this movie did well. Now the nun too, we have to have nun backstory. So a lot of it is, what are your players going to respond to? So in that first Stone Tape adventure, provide lots of little trails off. Maybe the guy who built the castle back in the medieval times was, you know, connected to the druids or something. And so if anything that they chase down, that suddenly becomes more important. And I would say that in terms of a backstory for folk horror, you may want to have sort of a great evil land entity, or a malevolent or at least dangerous land entity that things can be spalls of or sons of or shadows of or whatever. And that way you can have a cult, which is always good. Again, with the regular Bible, you got Satan. And then depending on exactly how you read the Bible, there is an argument that Satan has been given power over the kingdoms of the earth. So right there, that's a whole conspiracy story ready to happen. You've got the power of prayer. That's the good thing. But we have original sin, so we're always vulnerable to Satan. So that's the central nature of the horror. And I guess that's the other thing that you need, rather than an architecture for people to discover, is a way for the horror to keep being relevant to you. Because if you say, oh, well, I'll just stay out of Arkham, you haven't solved the Lovecraft mythos at all, because the point of it is that these maltheistic entities are everywhere in the cosmos. Similarly, if you just say, well, I'm going to throw Annabelle in an incinerator, surely the devil can no longer touch me. That's not actually true, because now the devil's mad at you for burning his cool doll that he has to rebuild using his devil powers.
And conversely, a mythos will tell you what a way of combating the problem is, so that if you're fighting Satan, the answer is bring an exorcist. If you're combating Carcosa, the objective is to try and, you know, keep your reality in order. If you're trying to combat the cosmic terrors of the Cthulhu mythos, you know you can't use ordinary human magic. That's all just a scam. Your exorcist is no good to you in that context. And so the underlying answer of what is all going on in the world answers the question, what can the players do that will work and what can they try that will fail?
So the other thing that you sort of need to get established early as opposed to late as it accretes is, how does the mythos entity present? And with, you know, Satan, he's working through the weakest and most vulnerable. With Cthulhu, it's bending of natural law at various places and times. With Carcosa, you have cultural artifacts that are haunting and terrifying. With this, maybe you've got sonic echoes. Maybe you've got sort of inter-party anger and fighting, some other thing, but you need a way for it to present so that you can find spore of this mythos, both in later adventures, but also in historical research where you're saying, oh, look at this. This case, it's bigger than we thought. There's a whole mythos behind it. So that reliable spore is another element of establishing a unified horror landscape.
Right. And so when you look into a historical document or incident, you can pick out the things that, oh, my mythos is vampire-y, this bit looks vampire-y. I'm looking for masks and tattered kings. Oh, here's a thing that ties into that. And so if you're looking at, you know, folk horror and ghosts and stuff, there's a ton of ghostly things that you can take to wrap into connecting reality to what you're doing, which makes the scares even tighter. But the thing that scares me even more, Ken, than a horror mythos, is the thought of running overtime, since it's time for us to flee this segment and see what the final segment is waiting for us on the other side of this here beautiful hand tool commercial message.
The British are coming.
The Kickstarter campaign is almost upon us for Flagbearer Games' exciting Revolutionary War role-playing game, Nations and Cannons.
Thoroughly researched and beautifully illustrated, in Nations and Cannons, you play as spies, skirmishers, and saboteurs in the battle for the future of the 13 colonies.
The next book, The American Crisis, Dark and Bloody Ground, follows the actions of the war in the South and the West with historical adventures, setting information, perfidious new enemies, and a sprawling campaign.
The Kickstarter campaign also features a revised core book supporting play in other eras, a supplement about political scheming within the two sides of the war, and years of maps, supplements, splat books, and adventures following the war from Boston to Yorktown.
Nations and Cannons is 5e compatible and focuses on unconventional heroes from underrepresented perspectives.
This Kickstarter is the best time ever to get into Nations and Cannons.
Sign up to be notified of the Kickstarter campaign at yourdadwilllovethis.com. It's time once more to creep our way up the crickety stairs and pause on the landing. We're going to wave to the portrait of the fire salamander. Just because he's a portrait doesn't mean he can't wave back, because he's a supernatural fire elemental. And we're going to head on into the parlor of the consulting occultist, where waiting for us in his smoking jacket with a particularly Chicagoan expression on his face, the consulting occultist is going to tell us about Chicago mail order occultist Sidney Flower. We've spoke already in this episode about a mysterious huckster with a whole bunch of different side hustles. Well, we've got another one, except this one is spooky, or perhaps willing to selflessly provide you, Ken, with esoteric information.
Precisely. Sidney Blanchard Flower is happy to provide you with esoteric information. Merely send $1 to the address at the bottom of this ad. All of the information that I was able to find about Sidney Flower comes from Mark Damarist of the Chasing Down Emma blog. It's a great blog for sort of turn-of-the-century, fin de siècle, occult weirdness. He also had a good bunch of information about F. Tennyson Neely, who was Robert W. Chambers' publisher. It's a great blog. I recommend it. Anyway, he also turned his synoptic eye to Sidney Blanchard Flower, who was born in 1867 in London. His father was an apothecary with a thriving line in cough syrups and other patent medicines. The father dies in 1877. The family moves to York. One of the kids is developmentally disabled, so Sidney has to be sent away, earn his own living. So he emigrates to Canada in 1884, and he farms near Winnipeg, or does something near Winnipeg, until 1892. In 1893, he becomes a reporter on the Manitoba Free Press in Winnipeg, and also becomes the tennis champion of Manitoba, coincidentally enough. And it is there that he meets Herbert Parkin, who is a psychologist. He is a devout hypnotherapist, or hypnotherapeutician, as they say, and he's the manager of the Winnipeg Victorias hockey team. Herbert Parkin, quite a guy, also basically created the Stanley Cup, so good for him. But Parkin and Flower team up. Parkin sends Flower to Toronto, possibly to learn hypnotism from Parkin's own sensei. Then Parkin is recruited to the University of Illinois to run the medical school there. That sort of goes sideways a little bit. He's at the University of Chicago for a bit. But anyway, Flower moves to Chicago to join Parkin there. And after these sort of weird academic ructions, Parkin sets up what's called the Chicago School of Psychology. And Parkin is the eminent authority behind it. And Flower is the salesman, editor, and driver of it. And the Chicago School of Psychology combines sort of New Thought denatured occultism, which is, you know, manifesting things and believing in yourself and self-hypnosis, auto-suggestion, plus hypnotic therapy for various things, and vibrations, because why not?
Right.
Everything in the world vibrates. If you can figure out what your etheric body is vibrating at, you can solve disease. And so it's this sort of re-shifted Gnosticism and occultism into the language of modern science, which is the same thing that the Theosophists are doing over in England.
Right. Do we know if there's still a Chicago School of Psychology?
The Parkin Chicago School of Psychology is gone. It is no more a thing, sadly. Though there are plenty, I'm sure, of Chicago hypnosis hucksters in the tradition of Parkin.
Right. And so now a bold step is undertaken by our protagonist, who goes into publishing.
Right. He publishes Hypnotism Up to Date and A Study in Hypnotism to popularize Parkin's work.
You can get that on the Internet Archive.
Right. And the goal is to take hypnotism out of the magic show and to say it's not sideshow trickery. It's a real science that can do magic. So he travels around the Midwest. He does lectures. He promotes hypnotism. And he's urging local doctors to set up clinics that will then franchise their materials from Parkin. Parkin is also, by the way, running at this time the Chicago chapter of the Society for Psychical Research, and he hypnotically trained his dog Esau, which is a parallel perhaps with Vladimir Durov's experiments in Russia, which we cover in episode 676. So we have a telepathic dog, or at least a hypnotically conditioned dog, which is almost as good, running around Chicago. He's a little terrier. He's delightful. So in the meantime, part of the approach that Flower brings is to publish a whole bunch of different books and journals that then cross-cite each other to create the illusion that there is a larger body of work behind one guy in an office in Chicago. So he, amongst the various pamphlets and things that he's doing, as well as the two books, he also begins editing and publishing the Hypnotic Magazine. And this begins with a lot of Flower's writing, but he solicits writing from other New Age people. It's sort of a, I'll mention your nonsense, but you have to talk about Parkin's hypnotism, which is fine. Then that becomes the Journal of Medical Hypnotism in January of 1898, which becomes Suggestive Therapeutics in June of 1898, and then that lasts until 1901 when it becomes the Journal of Magnetism, and then in December of 1901 it becomes New Thought, which is, you know, one of the big sort of vectors for this sort of American can-do occultism that spreads out over the country over the next century. So he does that with a guy named William Walker Adkisson as his cohort. So in 1898, he is also publishing Education During Sleep. By the way, Demarest calls this Flower's Perpetual Journal when he's talking about the magazines, because they're all the same journal, basically.
Right. It's like the Timely Comics shifting from, you know, Journey into Mystery into being Thor.
Exactly. In 1898, he publishes Education During Sleep, At some point, he has become an LLD and an MD.
Perhaps during sleep.
Possibly via diploma mill, possibly via just typing, who can say? And he brings in the latent powers of the human mind and body. So this is the, we only use 10% of our brain stuff sort of originates with education during sleep, that we can, you know, activate these unknown abilities within ourselves. In 1899, he establishes the Psychic Research Company as a publishing house because he has so many books. He's like, I need to be able to publish more stuff. And other people then send him manuscripts and he makes them pay to be published. So he has a back catalog. Occult and New Thought and Hypnotherapeutics all come out of the Psychic Research Company. In 1900, he marries a lady named Harriet McCurra, and this is a stormy marriage. Apparently, he kicks her out of the house within the first 4 months. They go back and forth. In 1902, she files for what is called separate maintenance. And in 1902, her filing is basically ratting out all of Flowers' activities. So she says that he would, not only does he wake her up all the time to discuss ghosts in their apartment, but he also, she lists all the patent medicines that he's selling through these various mail order companies, none of which are, of course, approved by anybody, including the best one, the Flower Health Cigar, nothing out but the poison. So he has a hypnotic lesson plan for quitting smoking. But if you don't want to quit smoking, you can just smoke the Flower Health Cigar, Robin.
Smoke a health cigar. You don't even need the hypnosis.
Don't even need to hypnotically quit smoking. So this causes a lot of hilarious newspaper articles about Cupid versus the spooks is my favorite headline. But there's a lot of people, Flower having, the trouble with being a big promoter of yourself is that your news when you inevitably come a cropper. So in 1900, in addition to marrying Harriet McCurra, he basically divorces Parkin and he sets up his own school, the School of Psychic Science, and sets up an associated Psychic Club of America. And according to Harriet, he has 10,000 members that send him $1 a year to be in the Psychic Club of America. And this moves his mail order business into a high gear. And so he has mail order pamphlets for everything. Send in, you know, $1 and we'll fix your problems, and including a mail order pamphlet on how to succeed at mail order pamphleting, which is pretty great.
Yes, just like a lot of the writing advice is about how to write writing advice.
Exactly.
So there's a book from 1901 that is published by his company that it sounds like it's by him, called A Course of Practical Psychic Instruction. And you can find that on the Welcome Collection site. That's with two L's. And it, first of all, has some old-timey illustrations, which are ripe for plunder for your handouts. And the text, I think, gives us an idea of his tone. So here's a little bit of the Course of Practical Psychic Instruction. Here is your non-magnetic man a failure, by his own confession, though he does not know it perhaps, weak, complaining, inviting failure by his attitude of mind, a spendthrift of thought, a waster of energy. Such a one is doomed by failure by the law, the unalterable law of cause and effect. So basically, this is the earlier psychic magical version of the guy kicking sand on you at the beach and you're having to bulk up to compete with that. Well, it's the exact same sales pitch that you will be weak and stupid and febrile unless you continue to engage in my psychic training and keep buying my different $1 publications. Like any other mail order pitchman, he knows the value of testimonials, as we know today from reviews on review sites. And the fact that some of the testimonials seem to be all written in the same voice, that's surely coincidence.
Well, that's what happens when you hypnotize yourself as you start writing like Sidney Flower.
Exactly. Dear sirs, it is now almost a fortnight since I received your book, Series B. I have to thank you very much for the promptness of your dispatch and also for the great benefit your work on personal magnetism has done me. I have not tried any of the others as yet, but I consider the work on personal magnetism well worth the 20 shillings alone. I am also delighted with the Kill Fear secret and found it a treasure indeed. I hope many others will benefit by your splendid instructions. Thanking you again. I remain yours sincerely, A.S. And the testimonials all also attest to the speediness of his customer service, which is exactly what you want in a testimonial. So that's great kind of flavor for a turn-of-the-century huckster who's selling psychic information, some of which might be real. So it's great to, you know, actually dive into that and pick up some of the pros and drop it in for your players.
And the Kill Fear secret is one of the things that he sells throughout every edition of the Flowers Perpetual magazine. This shows up over and over and over.
What could you possibly want more than to kill the fear in yourself?
Exactly.
You always succeed at your stability tests.
So in 1903, Flower moves at least temporarily to New York City, and he adds the poet Ella Wheeler Wilcox to the masthead of New Thought and continues to promote other New Thought cranks and promoting get-rich schemes and stock fraud. He has not only the stocks in his own imaginary companies, but he has, I have seen that this stock will do well, you know, thanks to my hypnotic clarity of mind, and maybe you should get into it.
Yes. Why limit yourself to one hucksterism?
Well, the answer is because once you start doing stock fraud, the post office starts paying attention. And the post office bars mail to and from both Flower and New Thought for mail fraud. Flower promises to be good. The post office unbars his mail. Atkinson says New Thought doesn't need this kind of seedy controversy. So he buys Flower out of New Thought magazine and moves the magazine back to Chicago. Flower goes west, maybe to mine gold in Colorado under the name of Haggard. This depends apparently on Flower's testimony. So who knows? But in 1906, he turns up in Goldfield, Nevada, and he starts a new mining stock fraud magazine called Goldfield Gossip. And he's using the name Parmeter Kent, which I love as a name, but eventually he reveals his real identity, one assumes ahead of the other journalists in Goldfield, Nevada. And he says he's doing this to pay back the old New Thought investors. He's running these scams in order to pay back the other scams.
Yes, people honestly invested in my psychic scheme magazine, so now I've got to rip off some gold investors.
And one of his enemies, by the way, in Goldfield is the labor union, because he is on the side of the bosses in his Goldfield Gossip magazine, and so they hate him. And so if you're wondering who was going to blow the gaff on Parmeter Kent, I'll bet it might have been some sort of union guy. So there we are.
Yes. Well, under any authoritarian structure, there's a bunch of hucksters holding it up like Atlas.
Anyhow, by 1909, he's indicted yet again for mail fraud based on the Goldfield Gossip magazine. He's arrested in Chicago in 1910, imprisoned in Carson City. And while in prison, in jail, rather, he starts yet another magazine, The Yogi, to promote yet more mail order schemes. So another coincidence with our previous case of guys not letting...
This gold thing is getting too hot. Let's get into Hindu mysticism.
Right. 1911, after a mistrial and a hung jury, he's found not guilty. So he briefly runs a Back to the Land magazine in California. Then he's off to Britain for a bit. He's mistakenly reported dead, but in fact, he was merely back in Chicago. He writes and publishes The Manual of Trichemistry in 1915 and gets into naturopathic salts. So if you're asking, when do we get supplements? It's 1915. In 1917, Manual of Trichemistry, by the way, it's not a big success. His mojo is basically gone since Goldfield. That seems to have broken his string, because he keeps trying these things and they keep not turning into a comfortable living the way that they used to.
Right. Because one thing you need in order to do this is a network of rubes. And once you've burned your rubes, it's much harder to build up a new rube.
And although a sucker is born every minute, they don't always want hypnotic mail order stuff. So that's the trick.
Right. The difficulty is finding the rubes, not necessarily the rube supply.
So in 1917, he moves to Louisville and gets involved in the oil business and starts yet another mail order stock fraud magazine, The Oil Pool.
Here's another commodity I haven't tried to fraudulently promote.
Exactly. That doesn't work. So in 1918, he joins the army as a medic, because remember, Robin, he has a pretend medical degree. So he serves domestically at Camp Merritt, until 1919. He gets an honorable discharge in the rank of a sergeant, unless, as haters will say, this is a different Sidney B. Flower. But since our Sidney Flower winds up in a veterans hospital, I don't think it is. I think it's the same one. 1921, he tries another marriage. He tries more magazines. Doesn't work. He does have a kid who immediately leaves the house as soon as they can. 1922, he teams up. He thinks, finally, I can ride this one. He teams up with beloved goat gland doctor John R. Brinkley from way back in episode 33. The guy who would transplant goat glands into you to make you young and vibrant. And he claimed even that he himself, hypnotism can only take you so far. What you really need is some good goat glands. So, right.
And that book, too, is available on the internet. You can get that one on Gutenberg.
Right. In 1927, his final magazine, which is called The Thinker at this point, craters. He becomes a reporter in Waukegan because the one thing he can do is type copy fast. He also apparently sells real estate on the side, which is something of a Well, I can't do mail order stock fraud scams. What's the closest I can be? A realtor. At some point, he moves to Pasadena, and by 1940, he's in the Veterans Hospital, as I mentioned, in Roseburg, Oregon, and he dies there in 1943. Forgotten, and I don't want to say unloved, but maybe underloved. And his only legacy is New Thought magazine and a series of impressive in bulk, if not necessarily in any one payday, a series of mail order scams, including no doubt ones that have been lost to the mists of time and history because they happened after his wife revealed as many of them as she could find back in 1902.
Well, I think, first of all, that it's very telling that his exploits cease for the entire period of the 1930s.
Yeah.
And we've seen that he has all sorts of skills as a miner, as a doctor, as an occultist, as a publisher, as a reporter. So clearly, that's the decade when he was being a Trail of Cthulhu investigator, right? That he's got a deep bench of possible occupations that he could draw on his character sheet. And obviously, by 1940, finally, the strain of investigating the mythos has worn him out. But this is yet another historical character who has a deep list of abilities to draw on.
And if you're looking for a vector for a pirated copy of The King in Yellow to show up in America, you can look no further than the Psychic Research Company of 1899 in Chicago. And maybe the irony is that it's such a bad manuscript that it doesn't cause full-on Carcosan outbreak, just causes other weird stuff to happen.
Maybe that's really why the post office shut him down for a while.
Right.
It's like you can go back into business as long as you stop publishing that play.
Right. And the fact that he's briefly reported dead in 1912, that's just fun. Any number of possible explanations.
Maybe he was
for
dead.
That.
Maybe he came back. We don't know.
Yeah. Maybe he comes back hypnotically, raises himself from the grave, gets himself some goat glands, and keeps on keeping on. So instead of being an investigator, perhaps he's now an occult villain following 1912 instead of just a regular villain the way that he was beforehand. And I do find it interesting that it's, certainly after his reported death that he loses his mojo and can't connect with the Rubes. So that's something.
Yeah, dying can do that to you.
Yep.
Well, having added this layer of gameability to his profile, I think we can hypnotize ourselves, Ken, into ending this episode as long as we re-hypnotize ourselves into starting another one a mere week from today. Stuff having once again been talked about, it's time to thank our sponsors.
Atlas Games.
Pelgrane Press.
Arc Dream.
Flagbearer Games.
Dark Tower.
And Pro Fantasy Software.
Music, as always, is by James Semple.
Audio editing by Rob Borges.
Support our Patreon at patreon.com/canandrobin.
Ensure regular delivery of this podcast alongside such backers as...
Yadge from Edinburgh.
Drew Eichholz.
Mark Kenny.
Neil Kaplan.
And Oren Gashuri.
Wear this show or drink it from a mug with Ken Robin merch at kenrobin.dashery.com.
Celebrate your joy of missing out with our latest design, Jomo.
On X, he's at Kenneth Height.
And on Blue Sky, he's robindelaws.bisky.social.
See you next time when, once again, we will talk about stuff.